everyone, and welcome to a Friends with Fantasy Benefits off-season podcast. Some early ranking stuff has come out on a couple of different venues, and I want to do some compare and contrast of how we feel about some of the rankings that are the most have the most parity between them, have the most disparity between them, I guess you would say, that there seems to be, a very much a difference in opinion about certain players between some major outlets' ranking systems. And so I think that would be very fun for us to look at and a good way to start delving into the player pool for this offseason. With me, as usual, is Steady Eddie, our Timex, Andrew Dewhurst. Andrew, how are you today?
I'm doing well, thanks, Chuck. How about yourself?
I am just fine, a little groggy today, but, you know, you get catch me in the AM, that's going to happen with the gig that I have, so it is what it is. Andrew, your Twitter handle is?
At Andrew K. Dewhurst.
Okay, and I am at Just Chucking It. Frequently on these podcasts, you guys have heard me mention some very interesting discussions that have happened in the FWFB chat group. And I made the momentous decision that I was not going to participate in that chat group anymore. And, Andrew wanted to make sure I was okay because there was some, there was a bit of a disagreement at hand. What's really happened over time for me with the chat group is that, is that I've had to come to the defense of David Stearns and the Brewers on multiple occasions. And I don't exactly know how David Stearns does what he's done so far. He's made 25 to 30 moves, and the only one that's really, really blown up on him, per se, within the public light anyway, is the decision to get rid of Chris Davis with a K, which Chris Davis with a K does not exactly fit the Brewers' mold in the he's a DH only now. He wasn't really an outfielder. Had one of the worst arms in the history of Major League Baseball to try and play him in the outfield. And the guy that they got back for him, Jacob Nottingham, is still getting drafted regularly in dynasty leagues, etc. And that's considered a bad move. And I just want to say that part of the reason that I feel uncomfortable now in the chat room is Milwaukee is the smallest market in Major League Baseball by far. And not only is it the smallest market, but it's impinged by the Chicago market because it's only 2 hours away. So it has the smallest television market by a ton. It's not even close. So, and that's the major revenue that comes in. So everyone can look at attendance and they can say, oh, well, the Brewers, they do fine with attendance. They do well with attendance, but they don't get TV revenue like other teams do. So they compete at a completely different level. So when people sort of attack David Stearns and attack what exactly the Brewers' future is going to be, I have a ton of confidence that David Stearns is going to do as well as you could possibly do, but I also realize that he's playing from a shorthanded compared to other teams. And, I've compared and contrasted David Stearns to J.J. Preller a bunch of times. A.J. Preller is his last name in San Diego. He's spent a ton of money on Matt Kemp, a ton of money on Yasmani Grandal, a ton of draft capital, acquiring multiple players that cost him a ton of money to build up his team that he had to destroy within a year because the team was not getting any better. And he has not added one major league piece that people seem to think is good. And so the contrast to me, I just, to be honest with you, I can't handle it. People love him now because supposedly he's got this great minor league system, which is wonderful. But he hasn't made a major league move that anyone has ever liked. Like, none of them besides the Brad Hand move, which now he flipped for a guy that most people think can't catch anyway. But the point being is that you look at moves like Will Myers, you look at moves like Eric Hosmer is unthinkably horrible for a market that's relatively small. And I can't even partake in people comparing Preller and claiming that he's a better general manager than David Stearns. And the other thing that's happened is that when I get sniped by people who are fans for other teams that have equally horrible results at the major league level, I really have a hard time with it. So you will not hear me talking about the chat nearly as much as I used to. I realize that the focus of the chat has gone away from a wide range of subjects at this time, and that I'll probably be back sometime before the season starts. Does any of that, what I just told you, surprise you?
No.
Oh, okay. You kind of had a feeling. I'm not pretty vocal about how I feel about things, and I'm struggling with getting sniped by people who are Mets fans and sniped by people who are Preller fans when the proof is in the pudding. I even told Andrew outright, separately in a separate message, it's like me defending. I'm defending results against conjecture because supposedly, you know, Cal Quantrill is going to be unbelievable in San Diego, and you know, prospect analyst guys, you know, they have all Fernando Tatis Jr. and you know, they finally brought up one of their second base prospect at the end of last year. Now they added a second baseman to block him. I mean, I could go on forever, and I don't want to do that. I don't want to just focus on that area of baseball. So I'm just mentally freeing myself up. So I'm sorry I took a couple seconds of you guys' time out there to explain that, but you'll notice a bit of a difference that I don't use that forum as much to come up with ideas for shows as I have in the past. And back to the topic at hand, which is the Fantrax Early 300 came out, and I wanted to use that in compare and contrast to the Mason Mox, which of course is kind of inherently flawed because Andrew and I are part of the Mason Mox. Yet, there was such a huge disparity between some of these players that I wanted to cover some of them and see exactly how we feel about it. And before we even start doing that, I want Andrew to mention the first thing that came out to him was that they had Bryce Harper at 19 on Fantrax. So, what was your thoughts about that briefly?
Well, I mean, I guess somewhere in between. I mean, the first thing I think we have to keep in mind here is that the difference between the two is one is ADP from mock draft and one is an individual's ranking. So the context of the two are a little bit different. But seeing Bryce Harper at 19, I mean, I don't think you're ever going to see Bryce Harper make it to 19 in a draft. And specifically, like, I mean, I've been doing draft prep for the 2019 version of the FWFB draft guide. So, like, looking closer at Bryce Harper, I mean, I think there's a case to see him going, like, easily inside of the top 12 to 15. And I'd be surprised to see him going outside the first round. But, I mean, the thing you have to keep in mind when you're talking about Bryce Harper is, one, we don't know where he's going to land. Two, I don't know if it necessarily matters. I think his power is going to play wherever. But if he ended up signing in like Philadelphia or someplace that's got a very home run friendly ballpark, that you could see 40 to 50 home runs with it, and you wouldn't be too surprised by it. I just 19 seems like extremely low. But again, like for the person who wrote that, I mean, it does take a certain amount of guile to just be willing to publish that, like a top 300 ranking. So like by no means do I want to detract anything from that person because of the hard work that they would have done to accomplish that.
Yeah, the average person who may be listening to our podcast maybe has not done a ranking like this, and Andrew and I think I've done it fairly regularly now over the past couple of years for FWFB. It is brutally difficult. And I purposefully went through, and there was certain rankings that I liked more via Fantrax than I did what was actually come up with in the Mason Mox, which is a collaboration of six different drafts done by industry people. So, I agree completely with what Andrew is saying. I do not mean to attack their ranking system at all in any way, shape, or form with this. I just thought it was curious to see how much of a contrast there could be between our conglomerate rankings, which is really what it is, and Fantrax 300. So, Fantrax is been wonderful, I believe, for the fantasy industry in general. So I'm not attacking them in any way, shape, or form. The first thing that really jumped out to me, and partially it was because I own him in multiple leagues, and I don't even know if I shared this exactly with Andrew, is that they had Max Muncy at 58, ahead of Joey Votto, ahead of Cody Bellinger, ahead of some players that it sort of stunned me that he was ahead of. I happen to be a Max Muncy guy. I love the fact that his OBP stayed really high last year. They used him at all costs in the playoffs. I do think maybe he would fit better on an American League team than he fits on the Dodgers, but seemingly there's no rumblings of them making any major moves that are going to make Muncy lose a lot of time. I think Muncy's going to play a lot of first base, and I think Bellinger's going to play a lot of center field. But keeping his OBP up around 400 for the year and using him as a power source deep into the playoffs are things that I really like about him. 58, I could not take him over Joey Votto. I don't think I could do that. You agree with that, Andrew?
Yeah, I can't. At 58, I can't. I won't touch him there.
Okay. Yeah, and I mean, and I don't. I think I'm a little higher than most people on him. I think, I could take him somewhere, sort of the mid to late 80s, if I felt like I needed power. But I think that puts me sort of on the high end. So 58. What you and I looked at were really the outliers. Most of the things that we're going to cover today, the players we're going to cover these rankings of. Are quite a bit closer than that. And like I said, that's one thing that happens anytime you make a list. You make a list so people can debate about it, and that's exactly what we're doing. So anyway, let's go through this list and talk about some of these rankings and how we feel about it. The way I did this as a format, I made it almost like a quiz for Andrew is I made Andrew align himself with one of the two rankings. Which one he liked more on these players. The first player that I thought had a pretty big chasm in his ranking was Eugenio Suarez. He managed to hit in the 280s last year, solid power source in the mid-30s, a solid RBI source last year for Cincinnati, a team that does appears to be looking only for pitching most of this offseason. Anyway, Fantrax had Eugenio Suarez at 28. And the Mason Mocs had him at 48. Which one of those rankings do you like better, Andrew?
I'll take the 48. 28 just seems it seems a little bit steep for me. I appreciate that he's coming off a great year. I mean, hit 34 home runs, 79 runs scored, 104 RBIs, walked at a 10% clip and hit for 283. Those are all great numbers. But all at the at 28, I mean, I don't have a third base ranking set in front of me, but I feel like I can get something similar that I feel just as confident in past 28. So, whether that be a Travis Shaw, whether that like there's some other guys I'm just more comfortable with than I am Eugenio Suarez just because. I guess I don't necessarily buy into the 34 home runs, although I probably should. He's 27 years old, so like going from 21 to 26 to 34 isn't egregious by any means. So, yeah, I'm still sticking with the lower number though. I can't buy in that early.
Well, I noted that his batting average dropped off last year in 2018. He was 312 before the All-Star break and 245 after. But his walk rate and his power was constant. I mean, he had 19 home runs at home, 15 on the road, so he wasn't purely a creation of Cincinnati's home ballpark, Great American Ballpark. So I did something that I really didn't do very often here and said that I actually like Suarez a lot in between the two rankings, in between 28 and 48, which I realized I didn't really give it as an option for Andrew. But 28 on Fantrax was before Matt Carpenter and Chris Bryant. I don't really think I'm comfortable corner-wise with him before those guys. I mean, Matt Carpenter obviously got a recent boost, which wasn't reflected in the early 300 when Goldschmidt was added to the lineup. And I believe in Chris Bryant long term. So those are two of the guys that I couldn't see him being taken ahead of. Would you prefer Chris Bryant or Suarez for next year?
I mean, offhand, I would prefer Bryant, just because, and I realize that actually as I'm saying this, that my reasoning is probably not overly sound, but I feel like it's more of a known quantity. But that being like, I mean, he's a former MVP, still very young, but I guess they're probably both around the same age. It's just a matter of. It's probably more about name value, but off the top of my head, I probably would take Bryant over Suarez for next year.
Well, you also, I mean, you can say it however you want, but as a generality, the Cubs' offense around him is significantly more sound and more battle tested. I don't know how much that factors into it for you. We're also making the thing. We're also whenever you are staying on Chris Bryant's ship, most people will say that they believe last year was a function of injury.
Yeah, and I mean, this is the case that I'll make for Chris Bryant is that if I take Chris Bryant at 28, he has a slow first quarter of the season, and I decide I want to jump ship, I'm gonna still get something back in return.
Yeah, Suarez.
Eugenio Suarez has a terrible first quarter of the year. I am probably getting nothing in return because. You're going to have a lot of people jump back onto the ship of, no, I always said he was terrible. You never, like, I don't know why you drafted this guy so high, right? So, I mean, that's kind of the safety in Chris Bryant is that there's a lot more believers out there and you have at that more proven track record. But that being said, I honestly think that the two aren't all that far apart.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at them on paper, they're a lot closer than you would mentally think. But what you're doing an important thing there in mentioning that you have to consider the player's reputation within the package of what you're getting if you're in a league that trades a lot. That's for certain. And like you said, Suarez is not a guy. I've seen him last significantly longer than 48 even. Which surprises me a great deal, and I own Suarez already in the three sport league, and I was very happy to get him. So do not mean to be pelting him either, or bashing him by any means. Let's move on to the next guy who I find really interesting, and that's Starling Marte. Starling Marte is noted is depicted as the 49th player overall in Fantrax and as the 33rd player overall in the Mason mocks. And I'm pretty curious as to how Andrew's going to feel about it because Andrew has a reputation for enjoying speed players a great deal. How do you feel about Starling Marte? 49th or 33rd? What do you think?
I think I can make a case for either. For me, I would be happy to take him at 33 if that's kind of where my draft slot fell. I mean, the reason being, I mean, Marte played 145 games last year, gave you 20 home runs, 81 runs, 72 RBIs, 33 steals. And still hit 277. So if you're playing in an average league, Marte is, I think, good value at 33. If you're playing in an OBP league, I think you kind of are, you're going to see him slide a little bit further than that because he doesn't walk. But I'm a Marte guy. I'm a long-standing Marte guy. Not a lot of guys out there are going to give you 20, 30 years. He's just hitting 30 now. So I think he's still got another couple good years left in him. So I think you can still expect him to give you 30 plus steals and produce you a reasonable, like a pretty good number of home runs. So I'm taking the 33 on this one.
And I can't blame you for doing so. Everything you said is completely true. 33 stolen bases right now is a heck of a resource in fantasy baseball. It's not nearly as easy to come up with 33 stolen bases as it used to be. I just want to mention that he's a very streaky hitter. He had a 194 batting average month in the middle of last year. He also, I think he was a little dinged up at the end of the season because those 33 stolen bases include 0 stolen bases in September. Despite the second highest games played of his career, because he hasn't been overly durable, 145. He played in 145 games last year. The 72 RBIs was a little disappointing because they actually moved him down in the order for a lot of the year. 81 runs is about right. My real issue with Marte is the team context itself. I don't know that I trust Pittsburgh very much as an organization to as to if they're going to. Everyone said last year at the trade deadline they made that trade to win now when they acquired Chris Archer. But I'm sort of noting the fact that this offseason has already begun with a huge thud as far as acquiring Lonnie Chisenhall. And they don't appear to be willing to spend money to add much to the lineup. And do I trust the pieces around them? I mean, Francisco Cervelli had a really nice year last year, but he had concussion issues as a catcher. That's never good. Then Gregory Polanco doesn't seem to be able to stay on the field. There's just some team context issues. I'm more comfortable with him at 49, and I've gotten him in a draft already. On my team, which means I obviously think he's a commodity for sure with the stolen bases. But number 33 on the Mason mocks was before some guys that I like significantly more. I prefer Rhys Hoskins. I prefer Xander Bogaerts. I prefer Anthony Rendon. And I wanted to make a note that team concept-wise, Lorenzo Cain went at number 59. And versus 33 for Marte. And at 59 for Kane, you have a better OPS, you have more runs scored, you have a higher OBP, and a guy who's in a much better hitting environment than what Marte is in Pittsburgh. So I actually, value-wise, strongly prefer Kane at 59 over Starling Marte at 33. Now, Kane hasn't always been healthy either. I get that part of it. Kane only had 10 home runs last year. Marte had 20. But Marte's power has not been constant either. I don't think you can draft Marte and assume you're going to get 20 home runs. So I think the difference, it's low tide for Kane at 10 home runs and sort of a high tide for Marte at 20 home runs.
I don't, I mean, I can kind of understand the argument there. But at the same time, like, I think Marte's always been a guy that people expected to hit home runs, and he's hit, like, I'll put it this way. If we meet at somewhere in the middle and we say both guys hit 15, I would give Marte the much higher likelihood of getting to 15. I would also give Marte a higher likelihood of getting back to 20. I think there's almost no chance you see Kane get to 20. And the biggest issue you might have, and the reason why I value Marte so much is because you, I mean, as you noted, like, well, he only had like 70-ish RBIs, and but Kane only gave you 38 RBIs last year. So, like, when you're paying relatively the same cost, wouldn't you rather take double home run upside, double RBI upside, while getting like around the same amount of steals, even if you're coughing up 25 to 30 points in average? I mean, I guess some of it's going to come down to how you're looking to construct your team, but I just think from like the overall view perspective, there's a lot of reason to like Marte. And again, that's strictly in average leagues. Like, Marte is much less value in OBP because, again, he doesn't walk where Kane, walked at 11.5% clip last year.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a pick your flavor kind of argument, and it depends a little bit to me on how you think Pittsburgh is going to go. It's certainly within the realm that they could be in the wild card race until the very end,
Well,
if you believe in some of their pieces. I mean, Tyone came on a long ways last year, and you don't have to judge an individual within the team context in every situation. One thing it does is it gives Marte a chance to hit in the middle of the order when maybe he wouldn't have that chance on a different team too. So.
yeah, and I think it also gives him like a green light to probably run as often as he wants because they know they're going to struggle to produce runs. It also probably gives them a green light to say, if you want to swing for the fences, by all means, because we know we don't have a ton of talent around you. So go out there and do your thing and, don't worry about everything else.
Yeah, that's absolutely true as well. I'm more comfortable with Marte around the 49 pick at Fantrax. I did take him in an OBP league already and got him quite a bit later, as Andrew pointed out. I don't hate Marte at 33. Like I said, there's a roster construct thing going on here as well. If you don't like much of the speed towards the end of the draft, Marte seems to have a floor that can justify him being taken in the first three rounds of a 15-team league, or say the first four rounds of a 12-team league for sure. So I get it. I prefer him a little lower than a little less compared to Andrew. But he's definitely a good player. Now let's talk about a player that we could have a much more varied opinion about, and that's Ross Stripling of the Los Angeles Dodgers. Ross Stripling went at pick 86, according to Fantrax, and went on average at 157 for the Mason Mocs. So why don't you fire it at me? What do you think your opinion is of these two rankings, 86 and 157 for Ross Stripling?
I like 157. And the reason I like 157 is because he's a Dodger. And we haven't the slightest clue what his max number of innings is going to be. When I look at last year's 122, I think that's kind of your ideal. Like, that's probably what you're going to get this year. I don't think you'll see – I'd be surprised to see any Dodger pitcher go over 150. If you get 122 good innings from him with a 10K per nine and, a low 3 ERA, I think that's great, but it's not worth a top 100 pick. So in this case, I'm taking the later number just because I don't I think his value is greatly diminished by his team and expected workload.
Well, he had 3 months as a starting pitcher in the middle of the season last year. And in those 3 months, his ERA went from 1.2 to 2.48 to 4.73. He had something there for quite a while, and then all of a sudden he lost it. He's 29 years old at this point. He gave up more fly balls than ground balls for the first time in his career last year. I also want to note something else about Dodgers' context is that they came out publicly and stated that Kenta Maeda was going to be a starter next year. It's pretty easy to start doing the math with Walker Buehler and with Clayton Kershaw making a ton of money and getting extended. And, it's pretty easy to go ahead and do the math and see how Ross Stripling, someone they've felt very comfortable with in the bullpen over the last 2 years, is going to end up in the bullpen. I don't have much of a stretch to see that. I mean, if Hyunjin Ryu is healthy, that's going to make a difference. It's pretty easy to see him spend a significant chunk of the season in the bullpen. And the 122 innings he pitched last year is nearly 50 innings more than he pitched the year before, which is, of course, a random earmark that we've used over time to say that pitchers seem to really struggle after they go through a 50-inning increase. And that 50 innings, you could make the argument, is worse than it would be with the pure starter, because those innings ramp up doesn't include how many times he was up as a reliever that he wasn't used, which a lot of people claim adds an extra toll to a person, adds extra fatigue to a season, being warming up in the bullpen two or three times a week when you're only getting used once or twice in that week on different occasions. So I am quite a bit out on Stripling at 86. I'm also probably not likely to take him at 157. So that's how far out I am on Stripling right now. I mean, he helped me a ton in some leagues where I picked him up last year, and he's got upside. I don't doubt that for a second, but the Dodgers have been noted for exactly how they use their starters and how they sort of keep them rotating into the rotation at times in recent years. And the Dodgers could go out and add pitching yet I mean, they're a team that is being talked about spending money this offseason.
I'll ask you this, though, just one really quick thing here. One last one on the Dodgers is, when you consider pitching value, would you rather have Stripling or Alex Wood?
See, that was one I really thought of. I included him in the list of pitchers that he's ahead of. I would prefer to have Alex Wood just because I strongly believe that they want to use him as a starter, and he's shown as much dominance in the last couple of years as Stripling can have, and I think they would prefer to use him as a starter in comparison to Stripling. I don't know if you can see that take or not, but I noted that at number 86, Ross Stripling is taken ahead of these starting pitchers. Zach Wheeler, Tanaka, Charlie Morton, Miles Mikolas, Madison Bumgarner, Kyle Freeland. I would much rather have all of those guys as starting pitching entities than Ross Stripling. So, I mean, I can see a case for Stripling because, you know, he's 29 years old. If he's getting better, if there's a lot of pieces on the Dodgers that are not regularly healthy either. So I get that take from it, but I would rather have sort of a known role going in. Can you see my take on this?
For sure. I guess the way I see it is that I want to get the Dodgers starter that goes the furthest down in the draft. Like, I think they're all more or less the same. Like, I think you're going to be satisfied with what you get from Kershaw. I think you're going to be satisfied with what you get from Maeda, from Ryu, from Stripling, from Wood, from, you know, from all these different guys. It's just, we kind of know that you're only going to get between 100 and 150 innings from all of them. So just give me the cheapest one, I suppose, is the way I see it. Because they're all going to perform pretty well. It's just a matter of, like, you just shouldn't want to pay or overpay for any of them, in my eyes.
Yeah, I agree. I noted that Maeda was at pick number 170 on the Fantrax. You know, that's a significant difference between pick number 86.
Yeah,
for sure. And I own Maeda in both leagues that I drafted already for this upcoming season. And partially I did that because 10.5 Ks per nine, once you get down by 170, seems like a pretty good commodity. And it's been fortified by the fact that they announced that he's going to be used as a starter by and large. He was pulled from being a starter to not reach some of the incentive clauses in his contract, which is a big difference. And then they used him to close when Kenley Jansen was having problems with his heart towards the end of the season. So there's I like Maeda at 170 a ton more than Stripling at 86, which is sort of what Andrew is saying. So we're largely in agreement when it comes to Ross Stripling. Now let's talk about some guys that were a little closer in the rankings, but, you know, we overthink the early part of the draft to a large extent in the offseason. The first one that I saw was Trevor Story, the 26-year-old outfielder for the Colorado Rockies. You know, he improved across the board last year, and he was a little more aggressive. He saw less pitches per at-bat last year, but you didn't see much difference in his walk rate. But he saw a huge jump in his homers over the year before and in his RBIs. Fantrax has him as the number 8 pick overall, and I'm struggling a little bit to move him that high. They have him ahead of guys like Ronald Acuna and Altuve and Freddie Freeman and Bryce Harper and Aaron Judge and like Giancarlo Stanton and, you know, JD Martinez. It just, 8 is a little bit too high for me. I'm curious if you feel the same way. Andrew?
I do. I'm much more comfortable at the 24 spot, and I appreciate that. I don't think you're getting Trevor Story yet on the 24th pick. Well, maybe you are, but this is kind of my fantasy kryptonite, as you hear Justin talk about from time to time. It's, I need to see guys do it more than once, especially guys that have fallen flat on their face before. So, I mean, Trevor Story had that, you know, fantastic rookie year, and then everyone was all aboard, you know, loving Trevor Story, and then he completely collapsed, and then he came back last year. So from my perspective, if I'm not getting him in a place where I feel like I can roll the dice a little bit in my draft, and kind of neither of these spots are, right? Like, you're looking at, if you want Trevor Story, you got to take him in the first two rounds. Then I'm going to be out in either spot. But I mean, because of that, I'm just going to pick the lower number here.
Yeah, I mean, it is awfully enticing to get part of the Rockies offense. I mean, that's for sure. That's an offense that has produced incredible fantasy numbers over time. So I get the attraction to Trevor Story. I also picked the lower number, but sort of stated that I would probably land in between the two numbers, between 8 and 24. You know, curious enough, on Fantrax, they have Story at 8, and they have Javi Baez at 13. I do think that I would prefer Story over Javi Baez, because Baez has such a history of plate discipline issues that I fear even more what could happen to him versus what could happen to Story. So it's tricky. The early shortstop options this year are especially tricky, because you have Carlos Correa, who is also coming off injury, and you have Seager, who is coming off injury. But you and I both seem to think that pick number 8 is too high for Trevor Story. Okay, let's move on to another high pick, and that is Manny Machado. Manny Machado is going at pick number 7, according to Fantrax, and is going at pick number 12 on the Mason mocks, which seems like a small difference of opinion per se. But at the same time, I'm going to surprise the world, and I'm going to say that despite all of the antics that Machado had against my Brewers in the playoffs, that I land closer to pick number 7 on Fantrax than I do at for 12. You know, he's coming off a career-high 905 OPS, and he had 14 stolen bases last year, and I'm going to harp on this point. To me, he's an elite, a mega-elite talent. Okay. When I was watching Manny Machado against the Brewers, I was taking note of how far we were away from him every time around the batting order when we were playing him in a big series in the NLCS. And to me, MVP, the upper echelon talent, is something that that doesn't go away. You know, I think he's likely to land in a spot that's going to help him for power versus, you know, spending a portion of the season last year in Los Angeles. And I think he can have a season where he hits between 45 and 50 home runs pretty easily and do it with a relatively good batting average. I like the fact that he could end up third base and shortstop eligible next year. I prefer him at 7 over 12. I've noted that 12 is after Paul Goldschmidt in the Mason mocks. It's after Trey Turner. It's after Jose Altuve. And it's after Arenado. And I would prefer Machado to all of those players. So what do you think, Andrew?
I mean, I look at this and say, I love to get him at 12, but I don't think he's going to be there. Which kind of brings me up to 7. And he's not a guy that I necessarily thought of a lot at 7. But I think, you know, as you noted, he's likely going to land in a favorable spot. When you look at the teams right now that are looking to spend money, like, I think the worst landing spot out there for him is going to be the going back to the Dodgers. But, I mean, if he ends up in with the Yankees, if he ends up with the White Sox, you're going to see some big numbers from, and I mean, some of the, I think we also sometimes forget, that he is just 26 years old. So like there's still room for some growth here. And I mean, at 7, if I can get his steals number from last year, if I can get that 14 steals to go with the rest of it, I think he's an absolute slam dunk at 7, and I'd be happy to take him there.
Yeah, I think 12 is, surprisingly, 12 is a little bit too low. And that's, you know, comparing them, the players that go, is it conceivable in some drafts he'll go as low as 12? I imagine it is. Some people will be adverse to him signing a bigger contract. But I'm also noting that his personality seems to be something like he wants the world to be against him. is what it appears to be to me. And so I think he's going to thrive proving a contract right. And, that's a head game that maybe shouldn't be played. But at the same time, when you're making, microcosm decisions, I mean, look at Jose Altuve over recent years. When you're saying, I would rather have Machado than Altuve, obviously you would love to have the best of either one of them.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not going to lose if you get a good season from either player. So you sometimes make these sliver arguments, and I think it could be a very strong year for Machado, and I'm not remotely afraid of him starting a new contract with a new team. I think he got a little taste of it when he got traded from Baltimore to Los Angeles last year, and that might help him in his next transition as well. Let's talk.
Yeah.
Go
The
ahead.
last thing about Machado is I think that he's a guy you can feel comfortable taking at seven because I don't like there's almost no chance that he returns you like extreme negative value, like outside of an injury, right? Like there's no he's too young really for to be falling off a cliff, and it's not like he's going to be signing in like Arizona or Pittsburgh or someplace that's just terrible to hit.
I just think 30 home runs is the floor. You agree?
Absolutely. I think 30 is even a little low. Like, I think you're looking at, like, Steamer has them projected at 33, and that's typically thought of as being conservative.
So I'm in on Machado, even though I don't prefer his personality and I didn't prefer things he did to the Brewers. Anyway, let's move on to the next guy who I think is going to be a very controversial guy this entire offseason, and that's Patrick Corbin. Patrick Corbin, they had at 29 overall on Fantrax, and they have in the Mason mocks, he came to a conglomerate opinion of 52. I guess I'll be kind of stunned if you take the high number here. Go ahead and stun me if you want to. 29 equals his age. He's 29 years old. So go
There
ahead.
will be no stunning here today.
Yeah.
At least not on this one, because I just see zero reason why you should be taking Patrick Corbin at 29. Absolutely none. Like, Washington's not a terrible landing spot for him, but at the same time, like, do you really want to use your second round pick on Patrick Corbin? Like, I know it's been done, and it was done in a recent, dynasty draft that we both participated in, but there's a reason why you're going to take heat if you're picking him at 29. There's just like, and I know every time I talk about Patrick Corbin, I say the same thing, and it's, I don't understand why anyone even bothers swinging the bat. He's only in the zone like less than a third of the time. You can literally just stand there and take a walk every time you come up to the plate if you want to. So, it in my eyes, it just leads to a huge amount of regression chance. Last year's the first time you've ever seen a K rate like this, where it was over 11. It's the first time in like 7 years that he had, or 5 years that he had a 200 inning season. So I don't know if you're necessarily getting a workhorse here. And the one thing that maybe we do forget a little bit of, but shouldn't be when we're talking about Corbin, is the one thing that Arizona had that Washington doesn't is a humidor. So, you're not going to, like, there was a very steep drop in his home run per nine last year. From 1.23 down all the way to 0.68. And I mean, some of that's probably has to do with never being throwing in the strike zone, but I just can't buy him at this price. And I probably would still struggle to even buy him at the lower price, but I'm going to take the lesser of the two.
Well, I mean, if you were going to play devil's advocate for Patrick Corbin, which isn't all that easy to do, if you look at his history, I mean, he's also got an injury history, obviously. I would note that he had a 2.8 ERA away from home last year, which is kind of impressive when you consider both the Dodgers' offense and you consider that he had to pitch some in Colorado, which is a particularly bad place to pitch. So I was surprised that he had a 2.8 ERA away from home and a mid threes ERA at home. That part did surprise me. One thing that was not odd in his profile, I mean, it was strongly noted last year that he threw slider after slider after slider, which is, which leads to a lot of strikeouts. Guys that throw a ton of sliders get a ton of strikeouts as a generality. And so 246 Ks in 200 innings is very impressive. But I want you to take special note out there that if you are willing to take Patrick Corbin at 29 like this, these are some of the people that Fantrax had him ahead of. Fantrax had him ahead of Corey Kluber, okay, which I cannot fathom all the Corey Kluber hate that's going around right now. Like, he still carried teams last year for 2 month stretches. So I'm not exactly certain why everyone hates Corey Kluber. Okay. That's one thing. You're talking about a guy who's got, the guy who's got American League Cy Youngs. Okay. Then Aaron Nola is the next one, which Aaron Nola has been on a steady arc upwards and has basically improved every single season. And he's on a team that is trying to get better. Is very much going to have a better team surrounding him this year. And Luis Severino, who Severino has had some struggles in the postseason. He's had slight downturns in his performance. But if you look at Severino's body of work over the last 2 years, he's done it for a 2 year stretch when Andrew has rightfully noted that Corbin has never done it for a 2 year stretch to this point. Most of last season, fantasy analysts spent waiting for a sharp regression from Patrick Corbin, and they didn't really get it. I understand that he didn't regress last year, but we saw a lot of smoke and mirrors in his pitch mix and how he was doing this. And even if it doesn't show it per se within the home versus away numbers, Andrew's right to mention the humidor as something that helped him even further last year. I really struggle with the concept of him going ahead of Corey Kluber. What was that one of the shockers in the rankings for you as well?
Yeah, for sure. Actually, all of those guys, even like Nola, and I think there was a few guys that I noted that I was like, oh, wow.
Kershaw is one of them too. I mean, I know that. I mean, there was and I think this is extending a lot of love to Corbin to take him at the 29th pick overall. And Andrew's also right to point out that the person who took him in our 30 team dynasty league in the second round took an awful lot of guff as well. So as a generality, the fantasy industry is not buying into Patrick Corbin, I think, at pick 29. Some of us are not even buying into him at pick 52. So that was one that surprised us a little bit. Let's talk about another player who I think is very interesting because he's in such a good place right now, and that's Xander Bogaerts, who is slated to go 61st off the board according to Fantrax and 48th off the board according to the Mason mocks. Where do you sit on Xander Bogaerts?
Bogaerts is tough as well. I think I probably sit closer to the 63 mark. Just because the nice things you get from Bogaerts are kind of things that you can't count on. So like he should produce a decent average. He'll probably give you a nice amount of runs and RBIs, and all of those things, but all those numbers have typically quite a bit of fluctuation. The spots where he doesn't really help you are home runs and steals. So like if you just take his numbers from last year, like getting 23 home runs is okay. Getting 8 steals is actually less than average. So like just the overall body here on Bogaerts is not one that's super interesting to me. Especially when you consider those two draft prices, right? So it's like, do I want to like an average amount of home runs and a below average number of steals at that price? Not really. I think you can probably find the run, like the counting stats somewhere else, and you can probably build a nicer base of average with a higher upside somewhere else as well.
Yeah, there's something to be said for that. I think one thing that's going to happen here with shortstop and middle infield in general is that you're going to different people are going to have a different tier drop off at those two positions specifically. He is still only 26 years old. He was 80 points higher in OPS than his former career high last year. He had 103 RBIs, which is awfully good. He hits in a really good, mostly young lineup. JD Martinez is sort of the only player in that lineup that you have a lot of concerns about health, although he would be a very important one. I think it's also interesting to note that he's hit 320. Last year he had 23 home runs and his career low games played, which is 136, I believe, and he's had as many as 15 stolen bases in the past. So I think Andrew is making a really important point about not necessarily knowing what you're going to get and having to decide if this is last year's performance is part of a career arc or if last year's performance is something where the numbers are going to fluctuate all over the board again. I believe more in the career arc, clearly more so than Andrew does. And it'll be really curious. This is going to be the most important time to note that when number 61, and Andrew said 63. The thing when you look at ADP is sometimes the 61st player off the board comes on average at pick 63. So there could be a slight variance in the numbers there. But number 61 is behind Corey Seager. Adalberto Mondesi, who's a guy I purposefully avoided in this because he's going to get beat to a pulp this offseason by statistics people. Ozzie Albies sits behind, and it's also behind Carlos Correa. And surprisingly enough, I like Bogarts better than all those players. I prefer Bogarts to Correa or Seager. I think there's a better chance of him getting to 10 or 12 steals, and I love the security of that lineup. So I think we got to Andrew's point. Xander Bogaerts is a tough person to exact, and he has been a very tough person to, prognosticate for in recent years. But I love him hitting towards the top slash middle of that Boston lineup. And I really liked seeing him have more power. I think if I told Andrew that he was going to get 25 or 26 home runs next year, playing a full slate of games, I think that Andrew would move him up accordingly. But it's a tough market at the top of the shortstop market. You agree?
Well, at the top of the shortstop market, I think it's not tough at all. I think there's some really nice options. It's that like kind of next tier down. Well, I mean, because I think when you like when I'm thinking of the shortstop tiers off the top of my head, right? It's kind of like the first tier is Lindor, Machado, and Bregman. And I know two of those guys aren't technically shortstops, but they're shortstop eligible. So you've got like those guys, and then I think you've got, the next tier starting at Story. And I would think of Bogarts as probably at least is probably a tier down from where you're looking at Trevor Story. So I think shortstop's going to be kind of a polarizing spot where it's a spot where maybe you want to jump in early and get one of those top guys because there is quite a bit of drop off as you start to go lower. And then I think it's really just understanding like how far off are you willing to drop, or how much are you willing to roll the dice on somebody like a Willy Adames to see like is he going to how much growth are you going to get there, are you going to see a bounce back from Orlando Arcia, some of these other guys that we've also seen perform well in spurts and we're kind of looking for a more of a full year from. So that's kind of I guess where I sit on shortstop right now.
Yeah, and we haven't even touched on another guy who's going to get whipped on this offseason, and that's Javi Baez. I mean, surprisingly enough, I would prefer Xander Bogaerts to Javi Baez in a vacuum. And you see Javi Baez, he's number 13 on the fan trax list.
I agree with you because I think Bogaerts is so much safer.
Yeah.
Like And I know I've talked about this in the past, but I really think there's so much chance for regression with Baez because of his bad contact numbers that like his floor is just so uncertain. Whereas like Bogaerts, you know, you're getting a decent, you know, you're going to get a decent average from him. And because he hits for a decent average and he hits in a good spot in that Red Sox lineup, he should have, you know, runs and RBIs to go with it. It's just, is he going to hit enough home runs to make him valuable at your draft spot? Because you can't really expect him to steal a lot of bases for you to make up any difference in value.
Yeah, I think that's those are all valid points. And if you're someone who doesn't want to get caught and play the shortstop gamble at the end, maybe you think Xander's the last of the top tier, and then you have to judge where the last of that top tier is. I think that is what makes Xander Bogaerts tricky. I will be surprised if I don't end up with some portion of my teams having Xander Bogaerts on them next year. Let's talk about a guy who's amazingly only 29 years old, feels like he's been around forever. Let's talk about Madison Bumgarner here quick. He has a huge disparity in the rankings. He's going at pick 58 in the Mason Moxe conglomerate, and he's going at pick 110 in the Fantrax 300. So where do you land on former stud lumberjack boy Madison Bumgarner?
He's a guy that I again, like I like the one, was it 110? Is that right?
He is 110 on Fantrax, yep.
Yeah, I like the 110 a lot better. The reason being is that I did, I mean, I'll note first that I personally don't think I saw him start a game last year, but the people that I have heard talk that did see him pitch said it wasn't special by any means. It's not the same guy. And I mean, maybe a year removed from surgery and all of that's going to kind of help foster that coming back. But I don't want to pay top 60 price for it. So if I can get him outside the top 100, I think that's a great price to get him at. And certainly a one that I'd be willing to pay before you kind of probably start to get into the glob set of guys that are gonna that you're gonna get into shortly after probably that one, sorry, that 110 mark.
You know, I don't struggle with people having their fears about Madison Bumgarner. I really don't. A lot of his quote unquote regression last year came towards the end of the season, which I don't think he really had a regular off season of work going into last year. And I noted that 7 of his last 11 starts were on the road last year. And 7 of those last 11 starts were against playoff contenders, so he really didn't get that sort of September breakdown that you usually expect. And in his last 11 starts, he pitched at Colorado, at Milwaukee, and in Cincinnati, which didn't help any of his late numbers either, I don't think. I guess what I'm gonna assume here is a couple things. I'm gonna sort of make my argument against what Andrew just said. I realized that Bumgarner didn't look like himself per se last year, but Bumgarner was always a candidate to be someone that didn't look nearly as good as what he was. You know, he wasn't this special velocity guy. He always got by on a great deal of guile out on the mound. You know, and I did expect him to look a little rusty last year. He certainly did. I prefer 58, actually, to 110. And the biggest thing is where you get in the pitching tiers. You know, how you feel about the tier of players that is going in this glob that includes Madison Bumgarner. And I think 110 is towards the bottom of that glob, and 58 is right at the top of that glob. So, you know, I wouldn't prefer to take him at 58. You know, if I had another starting pitcher, I may very well, you know, if I had two starting pitchers already, I would certainly pass at 58. But 110 is after these noted players that I strongly prefer Bumgarner over. Okay. Foltynewicz, I strongly prefer Bumgarner. Zach Wheeler, talk about a guy that we've only seen do it for a short period of time. It's after Ross Stripling, and it's after Jameson Taillon. And those are I don't think Tyone has necessarily the upside. Certain, you know, he doesn't have the upside that Bumgarner has. And the question could easily be posed, how much upside does Bumgarner have anymore, especially if he stays in San Francisco? But I think he has a significant floor, meaning that pitching in San Francisco and being someone who's got all this experience on the mound, seen all the different situations, plays in a very pitcher-friendly ballpark. I think all those things could really work in Madison Bumgarner's favor. I would not be surprised to see him uptick, not to where he was, but say get somewhere between a quarter and a half back on his value than what he used to be. And if he can do that, I think it's very justifiable to see him go somewhere in the 60s, say early 70s. Madison Bumgarner is another guy I sort of expect I will see on some of my teams next year. I take it from what you're saying that you don't think Madison Bumgarner, it's not one of those picks that you think is going to be terrible if he's taken sort of inside the top 70. If I'm reading
Yeah.
that too much.
I mean, I guess the way I see it is like, if you've already grabbed a top end guy, right? If you've got a Scherzer, you've got a Kluber, you've got a Sale, you've got somebody like that, right? And you want to grab a second starter and, let's say, you're at that 58 mark, right? You're looking at the value, you know what? I'd rather have Bumgarner because, I like the floor of what he has in San Francisco, then I think you can make that case. I mean, but I think you're being really risky if you're looking at it at pick 58 and saying, I'm just gonna wait on pitching right now because I'm gonna get my ace at with Bumgarner at 58.
Oh yeah,
Right?
you don't want to do that, no.
If that's what you're doing, like you're taking on some risk. And I mean, rightly or wrongly, like I feel actually at this moment a little, if I was sitting in that spot, I feel actually slightly more comfortable with doing it than I did 20 minutes ago. When I think of it as like, look, if you're picking at 58, that puts you, what, third pick in the draft, somewhere around there. So if you've started your draft with like, you got like Lindor, and then you paired that to, let's say I don't have ADP numbers in front of me. But let's just for hypothetically say you're getting what, like another really great bat, like you're getting a really nice power bat, and then you're getting another bat, and your thought is like, look, I'm going to get three big stud hitters in the first three rounds, and then I'll grab Bumgarner in the fourth because I think he'll give me 200 innings, and his ERA was still in the low threes last year, and everyone's telling me that this guy's not right yet. So like we give him a full off season, he gets right and maybe there is, some of that stud pitcher still in there. And what's the worst thing I get out of it? It's not a ton of runs or not a, or he's probably not going to get a ton of wins, but maybe in my next two picks, I grab another starter on, you grab a Tanaka or you grab, David Price or somebody that you can be a little bit more sure of the win number.
Yeah, I mean, you could go ace by committee if you really want to, and I wouldn't be dead set against that strategy. I mean, if you're taking Bumgarner as your first pitcher, you need to be ready to take two more pitchers in the next three rounds, I think is what Andrew and I are basically saying,
Yeah.
which you could justify because you could really love your value of taking hitters before that. It's going to be a strategy, and I think it's going to probably be viable. But I do think he'll be an interesting guy to watch. Maybe we'll start to get some reports when spring training starts of exactly how he looks and exactly how he feels, which can be dangerous. But probably, and it's not going to change, shouldn't change your opinion on Bumgarner, but maybe could add a little reinforcement if you're somebody who's willing to go back to the well one more time. I mean, it's important to note, I say, well, he's only 29. That should probably not be said with a guy like Bumgarner because they used him ridiculously hard
Yeah, he was
earlier
like
in
a
his,
rented mule.
yeah, in early in his career. I only have one more player on the list, and we are running a little bit long, and I just want to mention that in a player that I have ranked probably higher than most people is Jose Martinez, the first baseman slash outfielder for the Cardinals. Especially now that they won't be able to hide him at first base with Goldschmidt there. I'm still going to remain pretty high on Jose Martinez because a large sample size of me seeing him last year between watching, the Cardinals versus the Cubs at the end of the season, plus all the Cardinals games I get, being a Brewer fan and sort of rooting against the Cardinals. I thought Jose Martinez was easily their second best hitter last year. And despite the fact that he had all these off defensive deficiencies, they felt like they had to get him in the lineup. And if he were to land on an American League team, he would jump up like 50 spots for me. That's how much I thought of him as a hitter last year. Even being used sort of semi-sporadically down the stretch, he's still a guy who carried an over 300 batting average last year. I don't think you're going to get a ton of power from him. And I wonder how much your opinion varies from mine on Jose Martinez.
Not a lot. I like Jose Martinez, but with him not having a place to play, that's really concerning. Because I don't see him getting regular time in the outfield. He's clearly not going to be playing at first base anymore in St. Louis. But I do love the value at 168. Like, if you're going to bet on the skills and say the rest of it will sort it out, that's an okay place to start to do that kind of thing with a player like Martinez. He's not getting any younger. That's one thing to note is that, I mean, he is into his 30s now in spite of barely having, he doesn't even have, he's got, no, he doesn't even have 200 or 300 major league games under his belt yet. So, I think it all comes down to if he gets traded and if so, where he lands. The 168 mark feels just about right for me if he's got a place to play every time. If he doesn't, when draft season comes along, I think you'll see him slip further down than that. So he's a guy I would really keep an eye on that ADP on to see where he starts to go because I think he could be a really tremendous value for somebody, especially if you're going to get him like outside of the 200 range.
Yeah, I have a statement that goes in my head for a long time. I hate war because I think it overvalues defense. I think if you can really hit, they will generally go out of their way to make sure and find some way to get you into the lineup. And I think that's likely what's going to happen here because there is still a lot of streaky and there's a reason that the Cardinals really struggled for the Cardinals last year. So, anyway, I just wanted to mention him as well. 126 was, by the way, is where Fantrax had him versus the 168 for the Mason Mocs. Anyway, Andrew, we covered a ton of ground here today. It took us a little over an hour, which hopefully the people who are starving for off-season content will enjoy. So why don't you tell us your Twitter handle again and tell us anything you're working on in specific, and we'll go from there.
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at Andrew K. Dewhurst. Still getting back up and going with my weekly hockey article and doing a lot of work right now, getting ready for the 2019 FWFP draft guide.
Yeah, I'm also doing some draft guide work now myself. I am Chuck Anderson. I can be reached at Just Chucking It. Thank you so much for the download and the listen. We really appreciate it. Go ahead and follow us on Spotify or Twitter or your other podcatchers, and we will be here for you pretty soon. Next thing you know, we'll be into all the team preview podcasts, and your inbox for podcasts will be flooded. Thank you so much for the support. We will go from there.